The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is New York State Comptroller, my friend, a man I much admire, Tom DiNapoli. Welcome back, Tom.
Alan, it's great to be back and great to be in studio with you, not just by phone. I love it.
No, that's the best way. You know, it's great to see you and to look at you and look at your tie and your white shirt while I sit here in my in my T-shirt. Okay, let's talk pre-audit. You used to have a comprehensive pre-audit authority. And there was a big to-do, and I, of course, just raised it with the governor any number of times, and they took it away. I always understood the governor because he likes, you know, power. But I didn't understand why the legislature went along with that. Why do you think they did that?
Well, you know, it was proposed under the guise of efficiency, that the notion that to have the contract review that we had, that somehow slowed down the process. And much of this happened in the earlier
part of the government. Yeah, when the Republicans were in control.
Yeah, and you know, where I think there was a lot of deference to the governor. We objected and said this is a mistake. The process does not get slowed down. In fact, we turn around contracts very quickly. But, you know, it was part of the budget agreements as well. You know, there's a lot of horse trading that goes on. You know, some would argue too much during budget. Other issues are layered onto the budget discussion on the notion that, well, everybody's making decisions, so let's add these policy questions. You know, to me, in many cases, that's a mistake. But that's why it happened. And fortunately, many have suggested strongly that oversight authority should be reinstated, if not expanded.
And the governor agreed, right?
And as of the end of last year, beginning of this year, the governor reached out to me, to his credit, and said, you know, we need to fix this and let's put it back in place.
Well, I talked to the governor about it the other day. I wasn't happy about it because he had assured many of us that you were going to get that pre-audit function back. And in fact, you are the comptroller of the state. It's in the Constitution. You don't take powers away to audit from comptrollers because that's the way you find skullduggery. And we do know that the governor had a couple of aides who are now in prison. And the way they got there was by trying to rig things. And if you looked at the whole thing, my sense of it was that we might have caught them earlier and prevented this nonsense from happening if you had maintained your pre-audit function.
Well, and it, certainly if you have an atmosphere where there are checks and balances, there's transparency and accountability, those who would be tempted to subvert that might think twice. Even if, you know, on some of those contracts might not have directly been covered by, you know, the area that we're talking about. Some of them, I think, you know, might very well have, because we're talking about SUNY and CUNY contracts. And unfortunately, that's where you had this trail of money on economic development. You know, one of the things we argued for in our reform, Alan, and we talked about it on the show, is not allowing these nonprofits to be set up to be, you know, an opaque place to put money. And, you know, so I think that's another change that would have to come about separate from the issue of restoring our contract authority. But, yeah, no, look, our office was set up. The purpose is to be an independent voice, to provide a level of scrutiny, transparency, accountability. Anything that's done to take that away is a loss for the people of the state, for the taxpayers of the state.
He says the reason that he did it was because you were too slow. You were holding things up.
Yeah. Well, that's not right. I mean, we turn around contracts on average, less than 2 weeks. Are there some limited instances where there may be a very complex contract where it takes longer? Absolutely. But especially if it's a priority item and that's conveyed to us, we are very efficient and very effective in turning around contracts.
So is he a liar? In other words, when I say, is he a liar, he assured all of us that he had given you back this authority. Now it appears he didn't. And when I asked him, I said, he said, well, I don't know anything about that.
Well,
and I went after him on that.
Well, no, he's certainly not a liar. Look, we had a verbal agreement. And as is often the case, you know, you leave it to the folks who do the day-to-day work to then implement that. And I think that's where there's been a challenge. The best outcome would be by statute to restore that authority, because it was taken away through budget language, which changed the statute. We did have our proposal, goes back a few years. The Senate and the Assembly had language that was part of the budget negotiation. Unfortunately, there was a lot going on with this year's budget, you know, very much kicked off by the terrible shortfall we had at the beginning of the year. I think it's fair to say that, unfortunately, this issue fell off the table in terms of resolution. I was hopeful that before session ended, there'd be an agreement. Because, look, the verbal agreement is wonderful, and even if you have an administrative implementation, that's great. But, you know, this authority was taken away by statute. It should be restored by statute as well. We were hopeful that would be dealt with before the legislature recessed. That didn't happen. So, you know, now we're kind of still, you know, left with we have a verbal agreement, and I appreciated the governor's reaching out to me and you know, the spirit that he said we need to fix this. But it hasn't happened yet. So, you know, suffice it to say, and I will say, Alan, you're raising it is helpful. We have continued discussions at the highest level in our respective offices. And I hope by the time I come on the show the next time, we could say that it's been either implemented administratively or we have agreement on statutory language that will be dealt with when the legislature's back in session.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, Donald Trump, I don't know if you heard, is the president of the United States. And there's a real question as, can he be beaten in the next election, 2020, the New York Times and others are saying, hey, it's not going to be so easy. And I know that you don't want to get into the game of making endorsements at this stage. Nevertheless, I think it's incumbent on you to do so. So who you got?
Well, I assume you're not available because you have a wonderful gig. But
no.
Look, you know, as a Democrat, you know, on the one hand, I'm pleased that many Democrats are putting their names forward, but I do think the process is taking, I mean, we're so far away from the first votes to be cast in caucus or primaries, and yet everybody seems obsessed with all the debates. When you think of the enormity of the responsibility of being president and the way we have set up this process, I don't know that these debates have been particularly constructive in terms of illuminating issues or really identifying who'd be the strongest candidate. There's a lot of pot shots being taken at each other, which I don't think is helpful. And I think on paper, any analysis that I see, there's no reason why Trump, you could argue credibly, would be reelected. But that's how we felt in 2016, right? And he ended up winning. My fear is that we have a replay, and that because of the polarization of the country, Trump loses the popular vote once again, as I think he probably will. But he will play to key constituencies in that handful of states that we already know are going to decide this election, and he could pull off in 2020 what he did in 2016. And to me, the first requirement is a united Democratic Party. And I worry the way the process is set up and the months that are dragging on, we are seeing already too much disunity in our party. And that's an opening for Trump to win again.
Aren't those people who are up there in the debates, Tom DiNapoli, aren't they selfish? I mean, you know, to the point of we have a president who reminds me a little bit of Benito Mussolini in the way that he is conducting his presidency and the way he is leading this country. So the main thing is, as a Democrat, I think you get this, is to defeat the president. And when you stand up there and you're Senator Gillibrand or de Blasio or other New Yorkers, this is a trap, of course, Tom, and carry on this way and try to take a chunk out of Joe Biden, who is leading in all the polls and is seen by, in some polls at least, as being the only one who can defeat Trump. Don't you think this is a terrible thing?
Well, first of all, I think with all of it's going on, I still think Biden is holding his own. And I still, you know, would view him as the strongest candidate right now. I would like the debates to illuminate and inform. I think the Democratic Party should provide people with a message of hope and alternative policies and programs that'll make the country stronger and better. And these debates, and maybe part of it's the format and part of it's the fact that we have so many, that's not been achieving it. You know, remember one of your great heroes, Ronald Reagan? Yeah. You know, what was the 13th Amendment? Thou shalt not attack a fellow Republican. And Reagan had very strong opinions, right? And one might argue at a certain point he was in the minority of the Republican Party. But he always kept it on a policy program and optimistic tone and yeah. plane. I think our current crop of candidates on the Democrat side could learn something from that. And so maybe we need a 13th Amendment among the Democrats as they really head into the prime season, as we head towards Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. Don't move ahead by tearing down your fellow Democrat. What is the vision and the alternative that you're providing to Trump? That's what people want to hear. Because, you know, Alan, my worry is that if they keep bickering, it's going to depress Democratic enthusiasm, depress Democratic turnout. So the polls may show that Trump is still a minority president, but it all is going to be turnout. Who is going to be most motivated to go out and vote? And whatever else you want to say about Donald Trump, he has a motivated base. He gives them the red meat and they take it. And, you know, the Democrats should not underestimate his skill in turning out people to the polls.
Tom DiNapoli, just in case anybody who may be listening, and it would be a shock if they were, heard you say that Ronald Reagan was a favorite of mine. I just want to disabuse them of that notion. Nevertheless, he was one smart politician. No two ways about that.
And a lot of people voted for him who did not necessarily agree with his programs, but felt that he was a leader. He gave them confidence. He gave them hope.
Well, you know, you're a nice man. Maybe that's the worst thing about you, because you are so nice. People might want to take advantage of you, you know, like the governor, for example, in the discussion we had before. So I want to just make that point, and now I want to go to...
I'm not that nice, Alan, by the way, but I appreciate you saying it, but...
You've always...
My niceness is overrated.
I've always thought you were very nice. Let's go to an audit of the MTA Transit Capital Projects, which have been plagued, you say, by cost overruns and delays. And that's quite something because, as you know, the governor has been getting great deals of money from people who want contracts with the MTA, although he denies that. I wonder if we could marry those two concepts.
Well, you just did. So, I'll take maybe the latter point. We need a radical change in how we finance elections. And you and I have talked about that before. Everybody's been talking about it. There's this commission now set up as part of the budget agreement. We'll see whether it produces a change. At the very least, when people contribute that have business before the state, and not just the governor's office, my office, legislators' offices, it at the very least creates an appearance that there may be some compromise. And in the worst case scenario, you know, concern about there being a reality. Also, the amount of time spent on fundraising, it just takes away from the work of doing the people's business. So
Do you have to do it?
Sure. I mean, I'm not known for being a prolific fundraiser, but I have to spend some time doing it. Because if you don't have any money in your account, people assume that you're weak and or you're not running again.
Or
you're
vulnerable.
Vulnerable, exactly. Yeah. But to me, as imperfect as it may be, the only option that makes sense is to have a system of public financed elections, similar to the New York City model. Do it certainly for the statewide electeds. Do it for the state legislature. It will reduce the time that people have to spend raising money, make a better appearance and better reality, provide more competition. I think one reason why many people don't choose to run is that they feel I got to raise all this money. I can't do it. So it may not be a perfect system. To me, it's the best. So I think the fact that there were contributions coming from folks who do business with the MTA, I don't think it's fair to make the leap that they got their contracts because of that. Because, you know, the MTA, first of all, is a separate authority, and you know, they have their own process.
That's so
again,
says.
But again, yeah, but also again, and the MTA is a little different. But in terms of state agencies, is why I think you need robust oversight for the Comptroller's Office, because again, it's another check on
sure.
the integrity of the process.
So what's the holdup so that we don't get into this situation?
Well, I mean, the holdup has been a lack of. You know, traditionally a lack of will on the part of the legislature. Now, of course, you have a change with the Senate now being Democratic. And I think that's where they came up with the notion of having a commission. Now, my view would be better that the legislature and the governor come up with a proposal, have hearings on it, and have a vote of the legislature. Having just gone through a commission experience that I was directly involved in on the compensation, that was not a perfect approach and to dealing with that issue. So I tend to think that delegating to commissions is not the smartest
exactly.
way
when
to
all
do
else
this.
Failed,
so.
When all else fails, Tom DiNapoli, set up a commission.
Well, but if the outcome on this will be a change to have public-financed elections in New York State, that'll be a good outcome. Now, the other issue, and I do want to get back to the MTA, but the other piece of the commission's effort is this notion of dealing with fusion voting. And, you know, New York has had a long tradition to allow other parties to endorse candidates on major parties.
Good or bad?
I think on balance, good.
Me too.
Yeah. So I'm hoping I would not be opposed to raising the threshold. I think perhaps at this point the 50,000 vote threshold might be too low.
In order to be on the ballot, you have to get 50,000 the last time.
Right. Yeah. So I wouldn't be opposed to that. But to eliminate it totally, I would not favor that. But on the MTA, Alan, you know, for downstaters and anybody that goes downstate, the MTA is a huge issue. There's been a lot of problems there. You have new leadership. They're trying to straighten it out. It's going to take a lot of effort to do that. Our audits have gone on for, you know, certainly as long as I've been controller. We've looked at a host of issues. You referenced one of the more recent ones. But, you know, we offer these audits in the spirit of recommendations on how they can improve their efficiency, especially as they're trying to transform. We hope that they'll take our recommendations seriously. The capital program you referenced, it was a sample of about six capital projects. And just as you identified, we found timeframes that weren't being met, cost overruns, works specifications that weren't clear. They were doing some ADA compliance and they forgot to have the platform be adaptable for those using wheelchairs, which is the whole point of being ADA compliant. So just a lot of missed opportunities that cost more money. We're going to keep auditing the MTA. We want to be part of the solution there.
Uh-huh. Okay. So I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the gun violence that we see right now. We see a country that is just split on whether or not Americans have too many guns, whether there's a way to do anything. I wonder whether you in your role as controller or you as a top Democratic politician in New York have anything to say.
Well, it's heartbreaking. I mean, the incidents the past week, and it's not like we haven't been through this before, but the, El Paso and then Dayton right after it. I mean, you know, in the Dayton situation, I think they said in something like 9 seconds, those people were killed. And from when the shooter started, it was 30 seconds. He was shot himself. But you know, to have that kind of damage and carnage in such a short time. And what if the police hadn't been there? I mean, he had 250 rounds. I mean, imagine what would happen. And El Paso, you know, with the hate and the manifesto and anti-immigrant, anti-Mexican. You know, there are multiple, obviously, reasons why you have this happening, but you cannot escape the fact that we are a society that has too many guns in too many hands, too many guns that are assault weapons or rapid fire, that there's no reason why anybody should have that in their home or in their possession. Too many people who clearly are unstable or evil that have access to this. So there's much we have to do. And to me, though, it has to start with greater, we use the phrase gun control, but it's really controlling gun violence. And we just have to have fewer guns on the street. That has to be a national imperative. What we've been doing in our office, I think, as you know, because we're very concerned about safety for everyone, but we've been looking at how our schools have been complying with requirements of New York State's law, the SAVE Act, which was adopted a long time ago to have schools be prepared for emergencies. But in the current environment, you know, after Parkland and Sandy Hook and the school shootings, school violence is something we had to be prepared for. So we've done audits of State Education Department's oversight, New York City Department of Education oversight, how schools have been complying with this across the state. We did a sample of suburban, rural, urban schools. And Alan, we found that it's a mixed picture. The schools are not fully aware of their requirements under the SAVE Act. SED needs, the State Education Department needs more staff to ensure this compliance, making sure they have the proper safety committees. They're communicating with the public. They're letting first responders know what the building plans, the floor plans are, if, God forbid, the police have to respond to an emergency situation. So we're going to keep on this. And the schools want to do the right thing. but there's not as much compliance with those requirements. God forbid, we don't want to see that kind of an incident happen in a New York State school.
Sure, even with a multi-round gun of some sort, it only takes seconds for people to be killed. But if you don't do what you're doing now, it could be many more people go.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's that. There's something radically wrong. It should be an issue that people could come together on. But the NRA, obviously, as a political influence, not fortunately in Albany, but in Washington, really is an impediment to doing what we need to get done.
You've said that the state needs, ancillary to this, to improve monitoring of mental health facilities. What's wrong?
Well, I mean, there's a lot with our mental health system that needs to be addressed. And certainly, I think part of the issue of the violence that we're seeing is folks that have severe mental problems that have access to these weapons. Where I very much disagree with what the president said the other day, it's almost like that's all he's focused on. You got to focus on getting the guns out of people's hands and homes, because you know if you can get the guns away, then the mental health issues it become less of a driving force. But we've been looking at most recently, I think you may be referring to, we were looking at the compliance with Jonathan's Law. Mm-hmm. You know, Michael Carey had the terrible situation with his son dying in the care of a facility. So Jonathan's Law was really meant to protect the vulnerable. And again, we found there, looking at Office of Mental Health facilities, inadequate compliance with Jonathan's Law and leaving families that may be concerned about an incident that may have happened with a loved one that's in the care of a state facility or one run by a nonprofit that contracts with the state, that they're not getting all the information that they need. So we're going to continue. That is another area of auditing, because there are too many of these people who are vulnerable in the shadows, and we want to shine some light on ways in which we're not adequately providing for them.
Tom DiNapoli, I want to ask you about what we just saw, the stock market fall. What looked like it was going to be could have been 1,000 points. It was 300 points short of that. But still, that's got to raise the hair on your head based on the idea that, you're the guy who has to rise or fall based on what's happening in the market and your investments.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I wish you would have more hair grow rather than just have the hair that's there rise. But look, we're not day traders, so one day really good or one day really bad. Although this has been a week of downturn, the stock market, as much as we'd like to think it's about investment and scrutiny of bottom line, it's also about psychology. And, I think with all the disruptions happening this past week, with the continued, if not escalating, trade war with China, people are concerned. You got Brexit looming. I mean, there are geopolitical dynamics that are not favorable. And, I think it's the jitters on the market reflect that. But, the other thing is the historical strength of the market. This rally, bull market, has really gone on longer and stronger than virtually anyone in history. So at some point, it's going to go the other way. That being said, our pension fund ended the year $210 billion, about 95% funded. We are not just invested in the stock market. The stock market in and of itself, while it's an important driver, does not dictate what happens completely with the pension fund. So I'm still going to be confident that in the long run, as things hopefully settle out, I do hope that the president ramps down the rhetoric with China and they do get to some resolution of that issue, things will return to some level.
But Tom, you obviously have to make choices.
Yeah.
As a trader, you have to decide whether when the market goes down 600 or 700 points, this is a good opportunity to buy so that you come out ahead.
Well, the problem is if you try to time the market, it goes the other way the next minute and it never catches up, which is why for most of our public equities, for our stock holdings, most, not all, but the overwhelming majority, passively invested through index funds so that it kind of rides the market over the long haul. There's a lot of debate in the financial literature. Does it make sense to do what you just said, buy low, sell high, and be an active trader every day, versus just putting it in a vanilla index and letting it ride. And I think increasingly, I think even Warren Buffett has spoken about the value of index and passive investing. So we our bet is more on just staying with the market. When the lows hit, you just ride it out because you know around the corner there'll be some highs. It's worked well for us. It's why we're one of the best funded pension plans in the country. So I don't think we're gonna turn into day traders.
Talk to me about the pension plans for just a minute. We only have a couple of minutes left. You have to deal with the pension rates, the state pension fund. You set those pension rates. What retirees are getting? What do you do about that?
Well, in terms of the benefit, you know, that's based, you know, under the statute that we have, based on years of experience and your salary. There's a calculation, so we don't change that. When there have been new tiers enacted by the legislature, that's when that's been affected. But in terms of what we charge to our
government
employers...
Just so everybody understands, tiers means every time, you know, there's a new contract, obviously some of the people who have been around for a while are still in the old system you get new tiers.
But the tiers are not tied to contract. That's tied to state legislation. But the tier relates to when you start your service, and now we're up to 6 tiers. Most people are in tier 4, but we have tier 5 and 6 that are lower cost, lower benefit. Where we do every year, though, come up with a number is the rate we charge to government employers. So that's for state and for local governments. The rates have been reasonably stable, and I've been trying to seek a stable rate, but you're going to get an update probably around Labor Day. There's a good chance we are going to reduce our assumed rate of return, and that may have an impact on rates.
I want to ask you about marijuana. I live in Massachusetts, as you know, a very good state. My little town made $1 million this year because all those New Yorkers are crossing over and buying pot in our town of Great Barrington. And that's just not even the full year. Is New York missing out on an opportunity here?
My view is that if New York is going to move to legalization, it seems that we're moving in that direction, perhaps slower than advocates would like. The reason not to do it is because of the money. I felt that way about expanding casino gaming in the state, you know, because the money never comes in as projected. To me, the debate on legalization of marijuana should be on the merits, pro or con, not on the money. It seems that other states have been making money. To me, that shouldn't be the
reason. Well, have you ever smoked pot?
Well, you know, I was of an era where everybody experimented with it, just about everybody.
Everybody, but not
time.
Me.
Not
me.
You?
No.
Really?
No. No, I didn't.
You have a natural high,
I wanted to be a congressman, so I decided I couldn't do that. Yeah. So thanks for being with us again.
Thanks, Alan.
On the Capital Connection.